The Poet's Tale, Hyperion Kantos. In the beginning was the Word. Then came the fucking word processor. Then came the thought processor. Then came the death of literature, and so it goes. Francis Bacon once said, "There arises from a bad and unapt formation of words a wonderful obstruction to the mind." We have all contributed our wonderful obstructions to the mind, have we not? I, more than most. One of the 20th century's better forgotten writers, that is, better comma forgotten, once bon mode, "I love being a writer. It's the paperwork I can't stand." Get it? Well, amigos and amiguette, I love being a poet. It's the goddamn words I can't stand. Where to start? Start with Hyperion, perhaps. Fade in, almost 2 standard centuries ago. Sad King Billy's 5 seed ships spin like gold dandelions above this all-too-familiar lapis sky. We land like conquistadors strutting to and fro. More than 2,000 visual artists and writers and sculptors and poets and arnists and vidmakers and holly directors and composers and decomposers and God knows what all, supported by 5 times that many administrators and technicians and ecologists and supervisors and court chamberlains and professional ass-kissers, not to mention the family of royal asses themselves, supported in turn by 10 times that many androids willing to till the soil and stoke the reactors and raise the cities and lift that bale and tote that load. Hell, you get the idea. We landed on a world already seated by the poor buggers who'd gone indigene 2 centuries before, and were living hand to mouth and cudgel to brain wherever they could. Naturally, the noble descendants of these brave pioneers greeted us like gods, especially after a few of our security folk slagged a few of their more aggressive leaders. And naturally, we accepted their worship as our due and put them to work next to our blueskins, plowing the South 40 and working to build our shining city on the hill. And it was a shining city on a hill. Seeing the ruins today can tell you nothing of the place. The desert has advanced in 3 centuries. The aqueducts from the mountains have fallen and shattered. The city itself is only bones. But in its day, the city of poets was fair indeed. A bit of Socrates' Athens with the intellectual excitement of Renaissance Venice, the artistic fervor of Paris in the days of the Impressionists, the true democracy of the first decade of Orbit City, and the unlimited future of Tau Ceti Center. But in the end, it was none of these things, of course. It was only Hrothgar's claustrophobic mead hall with the monster waiting in the darkness without. We had our Grendel, to be sure. We even had our Hrothgar, if one squints a bit at Sad King Billy's poor slouched profile. We lacked only our Geats, our great, broad-shouldered, small-brained Beowulf with his band of merry psychopaths. So lacking a hero, we settled into the role of victims, and composed our sonnets, and rehearsed our ballets, and unrolled our scrolls, while all the while our thorn and steel Grendel served the night with fear and harvested thigh bones and gristle. And this was when I, a satyr then, formed in flesh as mirror to my soul, came as close to completing my kantos, my life's work, as I have come in 5 sad centuries of stubborn continuance. Fade to black. It occurs to me that the Grendel tale is premature. The players have not been brought upon the stage. Dislinear plotting and non-contiguous prose have their adherents, not the least of which am I. But in the end, my friends, it is character which wins or loses immortality upon the vellum. Haven't you ever harbored the secret thought that somewhere Huck and Jim are at this instant poling their raft down some river just beyond our reach? So much more real are they than the shoe clerk who fitted us just a forgotten day ago. At any rate, if this fucking story's to be told, you should know who's in it. So, as much as it pains me, I'll back up to begin at the beginning. In the beginning was the Word. And the Word was programmed in classic binary. And the Word said, "Let there be life." And so, somewhere in the Technocore vaults of my mother's estate, frozen sperm from my long-dead daddy was defrosted, set in suspension, shaken like the vanilla malts of yore, loaded into something part squirt gun, part dildo, and at the magic touch of a trigger, ejaculated into mother at a time when the moon was full and the egg was ripe. Mother didn't have to be impregnated in this barbaric fashion, of course. She could have chosen ex-utero fertilization, a male lover with a transplant of daddy's DNA, a clonal surrogate, a gene-spliced virgin birth, you name it. But as she told me later, she opened her legs to tradition. My guess is that she preferred it that way. Anyway, I was born. I was born on Earth. Old Earth. And fuck you, Lamia, if you don't believe it. We lived on Mother's estate on an island not far from the North American Preserve. Notes for Sketch of Home on Old Earth. Fragile twilights fading from violet to fuchsia to purple above the crepe-paper silhouettes of trees beyond the southwest sweep of lawn. Skies as delicate as translucent china, unscarred by cloud or contrail. The pre-symphony hush of first light, followed by the cymbal crash of sunrise. Oranges and russets igniting to gold. The long, cool descent to green. Leaf shadow, shade, tendrils of cypress, weeping willow. The hushed green velvet of the glade. Mother's estate. Our estate. 1,000 acres, centered in 1,000,000 more. Lawns the size of small prairies, with grass so perfect, it beckoned a body to lie on it, to nap on its soft perfection. Noble shade trees making sundials of the earth, their shadows circling in stately procession, now mingling, now contracting to midday, finally stretching eastward with the dying of the day. Royal oak, giant elms, cottonwood and cypress and redwood and bonsai, banyan trees, lowering new trunks like smooth-sided columns in a temple roofed by sky. Willows lining carefully laid canals and haphazard streams, their hanging branches singing ancient dirges to the wind. Our house rises on a low hill, where in the winter the browning curves of lawn look like the smooth flank of some female beast, all thigh muscle and meant for speed. The house shows its centuries of accretion, a jade tower on the east courtyard catching the first light of dawn, a series of gables on the south wing throwing triangles of shadow on the crystal conservatory at tea time, the balconies and maze of exterior stairways along the east porticos playing Escher games with afternoon's shadows. It was after the big mistake, but before everything grew uninhabitable. Mostly, We occupied the estate during what we quaintly called periods of remission. Stretches of 10 to 18 quiet months between planet-wide spasms as the Kiev team's goddamn little black hole digested bits of the Earth's center and waited for its next feast. During the bad times, we vacationed at Uncle Koa's place out beyond the moon, on a terraformed asteroid brought there before the Ouster migration. You might already be able to tell that I was born with a silver spoon up my ass. I offer no apologies. After 3,000 years of dabbling with democracy, the remaining old Earth families had come to the realization that the only way to avoid such riffraff was not to allow them to breed. Or rather, to sponsor seed ship fleets. Spin ship explorations, new Farcaster migrations, all of the panicked urgency of the Hajira, as long as they bred out there and left old Earth alone. The fact that the home world was a diseased old bitch, gone in the teeth, didn't hurt the riffraff's urge to pioneer. No fools they. And like the Buddha, I was almost grown before I saw my first hint of poverty. I was 16 standard years old, on my Vandayar, and backpacking through India, when I saw a beggar. The Hindu old families kept them around for religious reasons, but all I knew at the time was that here was a man in rags, ribs showing, holding out a wicker basket with an ancient credit disky in it, begging for a touch of my universal card. My friends thought it was hysterical. I threw up. It was in Benares. My childhood was privileged, but not obnoxiously so. I have pleasant memories of Grandam Sybil's famous parties. She was a great-aunt on my mother's side. I remember one three-day affair she threw in the Manhattan Archipelago. Guests ferried in by dropship from Orbit City, from the European Arcologies. I remember the Empire State Building rising from the water, its many lights reflecting on the lagoons and fern canals, the EMVs unloading passengers on the observation deck, while cooking fires burned on the overgrown island mounds of lower buildings all around. The North American Preserve was our private playground in those days. It was said that about 8,000 people still resided in that mysterious continent, but half of these were rangers. The rest included the renegade arnists who plied their trade by resurrecting species of plants and animals long absent from their antediluvian North American haunts. The ecology engineers, licensed primitives such as the Ogallala Sioux or the Hell's Angel Guild, and the occasional tourist. I had a cousin who reportedly backpacked from one observation zone to the other in the preserve, but he did so in the Midwest, where the zones were relatively close together and where the dinosaur herds were much scarcer. In the first century, after the big mistake, Gaia was mortally injured, but slow in the dying. The devastation was great during the bad times, and these came more often in precisely plotted spasms, shorter remissions, more terrible consequences after each attack. But the Earth abided and repaired itself as best it could. The preserve was, as I say, our playground, but in a real sense, so was all of the dying Earth. Mother let me have my own EMV when I was 7, and there was no place on the globe farther than an hour's flight from home. My best friend, Amalfi Schwartz, lived in the Mount Erebus Estates in what had once been the Antarctic Republic. We saw each other daily. The fact that old Earth law for bad farcasters, do not bother us in the least. Lying on some hillside at night, looking up through the 10,000 orbiting lights and the 20,000 beacons of the ring, at the 2,000 or 3,000 visible stars, we felt no jealousy, no urge to join the Hegira, that even then was spinning the Farcaster's silk of the world web. We were happy. My memories of Mother are oddly stylized, as if she were another fictional construct from one of my Dying Earth novels. Perhaps she was. Perhaps I was raised by robots in the automated cities of Europe, suckled by androids in the Amazon desert, or simply grown in a vat like brewer's yeast. What I recall is Mother's white gown, sliding ghost-like through the shadowed rooms of the estate. Infinitely delicate blue veins on the back of her thin-fingered hand as she poured tea in the damask and dust light of the conservatory. Candlelight caught like a gold fly in the spider-web sheen of her hair, hair done up in a bun in the style of the grand dames. Sometimes I dream that I remember her voice, the lilt and tone and turn in the womb centeredness of it. But then I awake, and it becomes only the wind moving lace curtains or the sound of some alien sea on stone. From my earliest sense of self, I knew that I would be, should be, a poet. It was not as if I had a choice, more like the dying beauty all about breathed its last breath in me, and commanded that I be doomed to play with words the rest of my days, as if in expiation for our race's thoughtless slaughter of its crib world. So what the hell? I became a poet. I had a tutor whose name was Balthazar, human but ancient, a refugee from ancient Alexandria's flesh-scented alleys. Balthazar all but glowed blue-white from those crude, early Poulsen treatments. He was like an irradiated mummy of a man, sealed in liquid plastic, and randy as the proverbial goat. Centuries later, when I was in my satyr period, I felt that I finally understood poor Don Balthazar's priapic compulsions. But in those days it was mostly a hindrance to keeping young girls on the estate staff. Human or android, Don Balthazar did not discriminate. He poinked them all. Luckily for my education, there was nothing homosexual in Don Balthazar's addiction to young flesh, so his escapades evidenced themselves either as absences from our tutorial sessions or an inordinate amount of attention lavished on memorizing verses from Ovid, Senesh, or Wu. He was an excellent tutor. We studied the ancients and the late classical period, took field trips to the ruins of Athens, Rome, London, and Hannibal, Missouri, and never once had a quiz or test. Don Balthazar expected me to learn everything by heart at first encounter, and I did not disappoint him. He convinced my mother that the pitfalls of progressive education were not for an old earth family. So I never knew the mind-stunting shortcuts of RNA medication, datasphere immersion, systemic flashback training, stylized encounter groups, higher-level thinking skills at the expense of facts, or preliterate programming. As a result of these deprivations, I was able to recite all of Fitzgerald's translation of the Odyssey by the time I was 6, compose a sestina before I could dress myself, and think in spiral fugue verse before I ever interfaced with an AI. My scientific education, on the other hand, was something less than stringent. Don Balthazar had little interest in what he referred to as the mechanical side of the universe. I was 22 before I realized that computers RMUs and Uncle Koa's asteroidal life support devices were machines, and not some benevolent manifestations of the animus around us. I believed in fairies, wood sprites, numerology, astrology, and the magic of Midsummer's Eve deep in the primitive forests of the NAP. Like Keats and Lamb in Hayden's studio, Don Balthazar and I drank toasts to the confusion of mathematics and mourned the destruction of the poetry of the rainbow by M. Newton's prying prism. The early distrust and actual hatred of all things scientific and clinical served me well in later life. It is not difficult, I have learned, to remain a pre-Copernican pagan in the post-scientific hegemony. My early poetry was execrable. As with most bad poets, I was unaware of this fact, secure in my arrogance that the very act of creating gave some worth to the worthless abortions I was spawning. My mother remained tolerant even as I left reeking little piles of doggerel lying around the house. She was indulgent of her only child even if he was as blithely incontinent as an unhousebroken llama. Don Balthazar never commented on my work, primarily, I assume, because I never showed him any of it. Don Balthazar thought that the venerable Dayton was a fraud, that Salmid Brevi and Robert Frost should have hanged themselves with their own entrails, that Wordsworth was a fool, and that anything less than Shakespeare's sonnets was a profanation of the language. I saw no reason to bother Don Balthazar with my verse, rife with budding genius, though I knew it to be. I published several of these little literary turds in the various hard-copy journals then in vogue in the various arcologies of the European houses, the amateur editors of these crude journals being as indulgent of my mother as she was of me. Occasionally I would press Amalfi or one of my other playmates, less aristocratic than I, and thus with access to the datasphere or fatline transmitters, to uplink some of my verses to the Ring or to Mars, and thus to the burgeoning Farcaster colonies. They never replied. I assumed they were too busy. Belief in one's identity as a poet or writer prior to the acid test of publication is as naive and harmless as the youthful belief in one's immortality, and the inevitable disillusionment is just as painful. My mother died with old Earth. About half the old families stayed during that last cataclysm. I was 20 years old then, and had made my own romantic plans to die with the homeworld. Mother decided otherwise. What concerned her was not my premature demise. Like me, she was far too self-centered to think of someone else at a time like that, nor even the fact that the death of my DNA would mark the end of a line of aristocrats which stretched back to the Mayflower. No, what bothered Mother was that the family was going to die out in debt. Our last 100 years of extravagance, it seems, had been financed through massive loans from the Ring Bank and other discreet extraterrestrial institutions. Now that the continents of Earth were crashing under the impact of contraction, the great forests aflame, the oceans heaving and heating themselves into a lifeless soup, the very air transforming itself into something too hot and thick to break and too thin to plow, now the banks wanted their money back. I was collateral, or rather Mother's plan was. She liquidated all available assets some weeks before that phrase became a literal reality, deposited $250,000 in long-term accounts in the fleeing Ring Bank, and dispatched me on a trip to the Rifkin Atmospheric Protectorate on Heaven's Gate, a minor world circling the star Vega. Even then, that poisonous world had a farcaster connection to Sol system. But I did not farcast, nor was I a passenger on the single spin ship with Hawking Drive, which put into Heaven's Gate each standard year. No, Mother sent me to this back end of the outback on a Phase 3 ramship, slower than light, frozen with the cattle embryos and orange juice concentrate and feeder viruses, on a trip that took 129 shipboard years, with an objective time debt of 167 standard years. Mother figured that the accrued interest on the long-term accounts would be enough to pay off our family debt and perhaps allow me to survive comfortably for a while. For the first and last time in her life, Mother figured wrong. Notes for a sketch of Heaven's Gate. Mud lanes, which run back from the station's conversion docks like a pattern of sores on a leper's back. Sulfurous brown clouds, which hang in tatters from a rotten burlap sky. A tangle of shapeless wooden structures half decayed before they were ever fully constructed. Their painless windows, now staring sightlessly into the gaping mouths of their neighbors. Indigenes breeding like humans, I suppose. Eyeless cripples, lungs burned out with air rot. Squiring a nest of a dozen offspring. The children's skin, scabrous by age 5 standard. Their eyes, watering incessantly from the sting of an atmosphere which will kill them before they're 40. Their smiles, carious. Their oily hair rife with lice and the blood bags of Dracula ticks. Proud parents, beaming. 20 million of these doomed schmucks crowded into slums, overflowing an island, smaller than my family's west lawn on old Earth. All of them fighting to breathe the only breathable air on a world where the standard is to inhale and die. Crowding ever closer to the center of the 60-mile radius of survivable atmosphere, which the atmospheric generating station had been able to provide before it began to malfunction. Heaven's Gate, my new home. Mother had not taken into account the possibility that all old Earth accounts would be frozen, and then appropriated into the growing world web economy, nor had she remembered that the reason people had waited for the Hawking Drive to see the spiral arm of the galaxy is that in long-term cryogenic sleep, as opposed to a few weeks or months of fugue, chances of terminal brain damage were 1 in 6. I was lucky. When I was uncrated on Heaven's Gate and put to work digging out acid canals beyond the perimeter, I had suffered only a cerebral accident, a stroke. Physically, I was able to work in the mud pits within a few local weeks. Mentally, there was much left to be desired. The left side of my brain had been shut down, like a damaged section of a spinship being sealed off, airtight doors leaving the doomed compartments open to vacuum. I could still think. Control of the right side of my body soon returned. Only the language centers had been damaged beyond simple repair. Marvelous, organic computer wedged in my skull had dumped its language content like a flawed program. The right hemisphere was not without some language, but only the most emotionally charged units of communication could lodge in that effective hemisphere. My vocabulary was now down to 9 words. This, I learned later, was exceptional. Many victims of CVAs retain only two or three. For the record, here is my entire vocabulary of manageable words. Fuck, shit, piss, cunt, goddamn, motherfucker, asshole, peepee, and poopoo. A quick analysis will show some redundancy here. I had at my disposal 8 nouns, which stood for 6 things. 5 of the 8 nouns could double as verbs. I retained 1 indisputable noun and a single adjective, which also could be used as a verb or expletive. My new language universe was comprised of 4 monosyllables, 3 compound words, and 2 baby talk repetitions. My arena of literal expression offered 4 avenues to the topic of elimination, 2 references to human anatomy, 1 request for divine imprecation, 1 standard description of or request for coitus, and a coital variation which was no longer an option for me since my mother was deceased. All in all, it was enough. I will not say that I remember my 3 years in the mud pits and slime slums of Heaven's Gate with fondness, but it is true that these years were at least as formative as, and probably more so, than my previous 2 decades on old Earth. I soon found that among my intimate acquaintances, Old Sludge, the scoop shovel foreman, Unk, the slumyard bully to whom I paid my protection bribes, Kitty, the lice-ridden crib doxy whom I slept with when I could afford it, my vocabulary served me well. Shitfuck, I would grunt, gesticulating. Asshole cunt peepee fuck. Ah, grinned Old Sludge, showing his one tooth. Going to the company store to get some algae chewies, huh? Goddamn poo-poo, I would grin back at him. The life of a poet lies not merely in the finite language dance of expression, but in the nearly infinite combinations of perception and memory, combined with the sensitivity to what is perceived and remembered. My 3 local years on Heaven's Gate, almost 1,500 standard days, allowed me to see, to feel, to hear, to remember, as if I literally had been born again. Little matter that I had been born again in hell. Reworked experience is the stuff of all true poetry, and raw experience was the birthing gift of my new life. There was no problem adapting to a brave new world 1.5 centuries beyond my own. For all of our talk of expansion and pioneering spirit these past 5 centuries, we all know how stultified and static our human universe has become. We are in a comfortable, dark ages of the inventive mind. Institutions change but little, and that by gradual evolution rather than revolution. Scientific research creeps crab-like in a lateral shuffle, where once it leaped in great intuitive bounds. Devices change even less. Plateau technologies common to us would be instantly identifiable and operable to our great-grandfathers. So while I slept, the hegemony became a formal entity, the world web was spun to something close to its final shape, the all-thing took its democratic place among the list of humanity's benevolent despots, the Technocore seceded from human service and then offered its help as an ally rather than a slave, and the ousters retreated to darkness and the role of nemesis. But all these things had been creeping toward critical mass even before I was frozen into my ice coffin between the pork bellies and sherbet. Such obvious extensions of old trends took little effort to understand. Besides, history, viewed from the inside, is always a dark, digestive mess. far different from the easily recognizable cow viewed from afar by historians. My life was Heaven's Gate, and the minute-to-minute demands of survival there. The sky was always an eternal yellow-brown sunset hanging like a collapsing ceiling mere meters above my shack. My shack was oddly comfortable. A table for eating, a cot for sleeping and fucking, a hole for pissing and shitting, and a window for silent staring. My environment mirrored my vocabulary. Prison always has been a good place for writers, killing as it does the twin demons of mobility and diversion, and Heaven's Gate was no exception. The atmospheric protectorate owned my body, but my mind, or what was left of it, was mine. On old Earth, my poetry was composed on a Sedu Decanar Comlog thought processor while I lounged in a padded chaise lounge, or floated in my EM barge above dark lagoons, or walked pensively through scented bowers. The execrable, undisciplined, limp-wristed, flatulent products of those reveries already have been described. On Heaven's Gate, I discovered what a mental stimulant physical labor could be. Not mere physical labor, I should add, but absolutely spine-bending, lung-racking, gut-ripping, ligament-tearing, and ball-breaking physical labor. But as long as the task is both onerous and repetitive, I discovered, the mind is not only free to wander to more imaginative climes, it actually flees to higher planes. Thus, on Heaven's Gate, as I dredged bottom scum from the slop canals under the red gaze of Vega Primo, or crawled on hands and knees through stalactites and stalagmites of rebreather bacteria in the station's labyrinthine lung pipes, I became a poet. All I lacked were the words. The 20th century's most honored writer, William Gass, once said in an interview, "Words are the supreme objects. They are minded things." And so they are. As pure and transcendent as any idea which ever cast a shadow in Plato's dark cave of our perceptions. But they are also pitfalls of deceit and misperception. Words bend our thinking to infinite paths of self-delusion. And the fact that we spend most of our mental lives in brain mansions built of words means that we lack the objectivity necessary to see the terrible distortion of reality which language brings. Example. The Chinese pictogram for honesty is a two-part symbol of a man literally standing next to his word. So far, so good. But what does the late English word integrity mean? Or motherland? Or progress, or democracy, or beauty. But even in our self-deception, we become gods. A philosopher-mathematician named Bertrand Russell, who lived and died in the same century as Gass, once wrote, "Language serves not only to express thought, but to make possible thoughts which could not exist without it. Here is the essence of mankind's creative genius. Not the edifices of civilization, nor the bang-flash weapons which can end it, but the words which fertilize new concepts, like spermatozoa attacking an ovum." It might be argued that the Siamese twin infants of word/idea are the only contribution the human species can, will, or should make to the raveling cosmos. Yes, our DNA is unique, but so is a salamander's. Yes, we construct artifacts, but so have species ranging from beavers to the architect ants whose crenellated towers are visible right now off the port bow. Yes, we weave real fabric things from the dream stuff of mathematics, but the universe is hardwired with arithmetic. Scratch a circle, and pi peeps out. Enter a new solar system, and Tycho Brahe's formulae lie waiting under the black velvet cloak of space-time. But where has the universe hidden a word under its outer layer of biology, geometry, or insensate rock? Even the traces of other intelligent life we have found, the blimps on Jove II, the labyrinth builders, the Senescii empaths on Hebron, the stick people of Durulus, the architects of the time tombs, the Shrike itself, have left us mysteries and obscure artifacts, but no language, no words. The poet John Keats once wrote to a friend of his named Bailey, "I am certain of nothing but the holiness of the heart's affection and the truth of imagination. What the imagination seizes as beauty must be truth, whether it existed before or not." The Chinese poet George Wu, who died in the last Sino-Japanese War about 3 centuries before the Hegira, understood this when he recorded on his comm log, "Poets are the mad midwives to reality. They see not what is, nor what can be, but what must become." Later on his last disc, to his lover the week before he died, Wu said, "Words are the only bullets in truth's bandolier, and poets are the snipers." You see, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was made flesh in the weave of the human universe, and only the poet can expand this universe, finding shortcuts to new realities the way the Hawking Drive tunnels under the barriers of Einsteinian space-time. To be a poet, I realized, a true poet, was to become the avatar of humanity incarnate. To accept the mantle of poet is to carry the cross of the Son of Man, to suffer the birth pangs of the soul mother of humanity. To be a true poet is to become God. I tried to explain this to my friends on Heaven's Gate. "Piss shit," I said. "Asshole, motherfucker, goddamn shit, goddamn cunt. Pee-pee cunt! Goddamn!" They shook their heads and smiled and walked away. Great poets are rarely understood in their own day. The yellow-brown clouds rained acid on me. I waded in mud up to my thighs and cleaned leechweed from the city sewer pipes. Old Sludge died during my second year there. When we were all working on a project extending the First Avenue Canal to the Midsump mudflats. An accident. He was climbing a slime dune to rescue a single sulfur rose from the advancing grouter when there was a mudquake. Kati married shortly after that. She still worked part-time as a crib doxy, but I saw less and less of her. She died in childbirth shortly after the green tsunami carried away Mudflat City. I continued to write poetry. How is it, you might ask, that someone can write fine verse with a vocabulary of only 9 right hemisphere words? The answer is that I used no words at all. Poetry is only secondarily about words. Primarily, it is about truth. I dealt with the Ding an sich, the substance behind the shadow, weaving powerful concepts, similes, and connections the way an engineer would raise a skyscraper with the whiskered alloy skeleton being constructed long before the glass and plastic and chrome aluminum appears. And slowly the words returned. The brain retains and retools itself amazingly well. What had been lost in the left hemisphere found a home elsewhere, or reasserted their primacy in the damaged regions, like pioneers returning to a fire-damaged plain made more fertile by the flames. Where before, a simple word like salt would leave me stuttering and gasping, my mind probing emptiness like a tongue prodding the socket of a missing tooth. Now, the words and phrases flowed back slowly, like the names of forgotten playmates. During the day, I labored in the slime fields, but at night, I sat at my splintered table and wrote my contus by the light of a hissing ghee lamp. Mark Twain once opined in his homey way, "The difference between the right word and the almost right word is the difference between lightning and the lightning bug." He was droll, but incomplete. During those long months of beginning my contos on Heaven's Gate, I discovered that the difference between finding the right word as opposed to accepting the almost right word was the difference between being struck by lightning and merely watching a lightning display. So my contos began and grew. Written on the flimsy sheets of recycled leechweed fiber, which they issued by the ton for use as toilet paper, scribbled by one of the cheap felt-tip pens sold at the company store, the contos took shape. As the words returned, slipping into place like once scattered pieces of a 3D puzzle, I needed a form. Returning to Don Balthazar's teachings, I tried on the measured nobility of Milton's epic verse. Gaining confidence, I added the romantic sensuality of a Byron matured by a Keatsish celebration of the language. Stirring all this, I seasoned the mixture with a dash of Yeats' brilliant cynicism and a pinch of Pound's obscure scholastic arrogance. I chopped, diced, and added such ingredients as Eliot's control of imagery, Dylan Thomas's feel for place, Delmore Schwartz's sense of doom, Steve Thames' touch of horror, Salmid Brevi's plea for innocence, Dayton's love of the convoluted rhyme scheme, Wu's worship of the physical, and Edmund Key Ferrera's radical playfulness. In the end, of course, I threw this entire mixture out and wrote the contos in a style all my own. If it had not been for Unk, the slumyard bully, I probably still would be on Heaven's Gate, digging acid canals by day and writing contos by night. It was my day off, and I was carrying my contos, the only copy of my manuscript, to the company library in the common hall to do some research, when Unk and two of his cronies appeared from an alley and demanded immediate payment of the next month's protection money. We had no universal cards in the Heaven's Gate atmospheric protectorate. We paid our debts in company scrip or bootleg marks. I had neither. Unk demanded to see what was in my plastic shoulder bag. Without thinking, I refused. It was a mistake. If I'd shown Unk the manuscript, he most probably would have scattered it in the mud and slapped me around after making threats. As it was, my refusal angered him, so he and his two Neanderthal companions tore open the bag, scattered the manuscript in the mud, and beat me within the proverbial inch of my life. It so happened that on this day, an EMV belonging to a protectorate air quality control manager was passing low above, and the wife of the manager, traveling alone to the Ark's company residential store, ordered the EMV down, had her android servant retrieve me, and what was left of my contos, and then personally drove me to the company hospital. Normally, the members of the bonded workforce received medical aid, if any, at the walk-in bioclinic, but the hospital did not want to refuse the wife of a manager, so I was admitted, still unconscious, and watched over by a human doctor and the manager's wife while I recovered in a healing tank. All right. To make a banal long story into a banal short story, I'll cut to the uplink. Helenda, that was the manager's wife, read my manuscript while I was floating in renewal nutrient. She liked it. On the same day I was being decanted in the company hospital, Helenda farcast to Renaissance, where she showed my Kantos to her sister Philia, who had a friend whose lover knew an editor at Transline Publishing. When I awoke the next day, my broken ribs had been set, my shattered cheekbone had been healed, my bruises were gone, and I'd received 5 new teeth, a new cornea for my left eye, and a contract with Transline. My book came out 5 weeks later. A week after that, Helenda divorced her manager and married me. It was her 7th marriage, my first. We honeymooned on the concourse, and when we returned a month later, my book had sold more than 1 billion copies, the first book of verse to hit the bestseller lists in 4 centuries. And I was a millionaire many times over.